You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear the stories and songs of some up-and-coming Wisconsin bands. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, and the big story is the federal court order issued today calling on Wisconsin lawmakers to redraw voting boundary lines in an ongoing lawsuit that's likely to be settled by the U.S. Supreme Court. Robert Menser is with us. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks.
What did we hear today from this U.S. District Court when it comes to redistricting?
Yeah, we had some big breaking news on a Friday, and this time the courts were at least had the decency to do it in the morning and not wait until,
yeah, we had that right run now of court announcements that kept happening, you know, after we went off the air.
Yeah, when
was a couple years
I was ready
back
to go home. Thank you very much. Yeah, so this follows from the court decision in November that found that that Wisconsin's 2011 voting maps were unconstitutional. So once the court had determined that the maps were unconstitutional, it was the question that remained was who or when or how will the state need to redress that and change that, right? So one option was the court could have redrawn it, a judge could have. They could have said, well, you know, you don't have to do anything until the Supreme Court reviews this. And today's decision is that Wisconsin legislators and Governor Scott Walker, it is on them. They have until November 1st to come up with new voting maps so that it'll be in time for next year's midterms.
And the plaintiffs in this case, they were making the case that the way these were drawn it was kind of drawn precisely to disenfranchise, to minimize the votes of the impact of votes of Democrats, as I understand the case. But they were hoping, they wanted the courts to do this instead of the legislature, largely the same people who drew the original maps that are under challenge here, right?
Right. So, you know, like most states, Wisconsin lets politicians choose their voters. So when you do redistricting every 10 years, it's the legislature that does it. This in this case, the 2011 maps came right after Republicans had been swept into office, and they drew these very Republican maps. They drew maps that tilted in favor of keeping Republican legislators in office, and that's what you would expect a politician to do. So the question with this it really has never been whether there were sort of political considerations or political motivations behind these districts. It was whether they had gone so far as to violate any sort of election laws. This particular challenge, it is a different type of challenge than what had been brought before. It's a bit of a novel interpretation. Yeah, the decision, the panel of judges said that the maps were, quote, intended to burden the representational rights of Democratic voters. It's a bit hard to know quite how now back in the hands still of unified Republican leadership, how that gets changed, or what, you know, sort of how far they can go without going too far.
And what have we seen from Democrats and Republicans in response to this so far today?
Well, so a few things. The first thing to know is that this is subject to appeal. This is a federal court, but it could go to the Supreme Court. It's a bit hard to know what the Supreme Court is even going to look like in the future, but it certainly could happen that the U.S. Supreme Court will order a stop to this and say that the maps are fine and there's no problem. That is what Republicans hope will happen. That's what Governor Scott Walker said sort of shortly after the initial decision was announced in November. And so I think that that's what Republicans are hoping, and that from their perspective of what they say, that they believe the law is on their side. Democrats are, you know, I mean, Democrats are jubilant about this. This for sure is in some sense a vindication of claims that they've been making for a long time about the 2010 maps. And yeah, I think there's some hope that it will have an effect in the midterms.
And if this stayed true, if the Supreme Court says, yep, those original maps were unconstitutional, you do have to redraw them, those maps would just be in place for the 2018 and 2020 elections, and then the new legislature gets to draw up a whole new set of maps.
That's right. That's right. And we go through, and we rinse and repeat, right?
Right.
Couple things that are worth saying. This applies to state senate and state assembly districts. This does not apply to congressional districts, even though those also were redrawn in 2011 and some were changed fairly dramatically. Those are off the table. This is about state races. Also probably worth saying that Wisconsin has experienced big political changes since 2010, and it's not the case that this voting map has been the only thing or like the main thing that has driven Wisconsin's changes in Wisconsin that made it arguably a red state. Governor Walker has been reelected statewide, and of course, in 2016, Wisconsin's electoral votes went to Donald Trump. Those elections had nothing to do with districts because they were statewide elections. So, you know, the districts, the way the districts are drawn, certainly matters. It certainly matters in these state and assembly races. But you know, it's far from it's not a slam dunk that this necessarily has been definitive in any election.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network, Wisconsin, a weekly Wisconsin News Roundup here on Central Time. Want to touch on a couple of stories, Rob. The big transportation audit, the eagerly anticipated transportation audit, not a phrase you hear often, but it did drop some big news. What did we learn yesterday?
Yeah, you know, Rob, what is a few hundred million dollars between friends? I mean, it's a few hundred million there, it's a few hundred million here. Pretty soon, you have underestimated the cost of Wisconsin road projects by $773 million between 2006 and 2015. So that's what the audit found, that Wisconsin's highway projects are consistently blowing through projected budget numbers. And this, you know, I mean, I think that most people who follow this stuff kind of know that a lot of times these individual products will run long or run over budget, but this is dropped in the middle of, you know, what something that we've talked about probably many times at this point is kind of the biggest or the most contentious state budget issue, and for sure it's going to provide ammo as we go into this this process of deciding how much money the state's going to put into roads.
And three major Republican assembly leaders, Speaker Robin Voss, Majority Leader Jim Steinke, John Nygren, who's on the Joint Finance Committee, said today they want new estimates on the costs of future projects. So they're taking this thing and integrating it into that transportation debate right away.
Yeah, I mean, at a minimum. So one of the findings is that the department had not been estimating for inflation, the cost of just normal inflation, as some of these projects that might take years and years to complete. The cost of materials goes up, the cost of labor goes up. That seems like that would be a normal part of calculations, but it hasn't been. So I mean, there are things like that seem fairly ripe for some change.
And then turning to the ongoing story of Sheriff David Clark, a lot of criticism, a lot of controversy lately, harassment on an airplane, deaths in the Milwaukee County Jail, a lot of back and forth, wars of words going on between the sheriff and others. What's the latest part of the story you're watching?
Yeah, we touched on this last week, and a Milwaukee resident filed a complaint against Clark after Clark had the man detained and questioned at Mitchell International Airport and then escorted out of the airport because, I mean, you know, you say harassment on a plane, but according to the complaint, the man shook his head at Sheriff Clark because Clark was dressed in Cowboys gear. So anyway, this week, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported that the county has launched a formal investigation into the complaint. They've interviewed people at the airport. They've interviewed the man who made the complaint. So that will continue through official channels. Maybe of note, although maybe not, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's editorial board also wrote this week that Clark needs to go. So some criticism of him from a few quarters.
Rob, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
That's Rob Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about foreign policy in the Trump administration as meetings are set with and some canceled between the president and leaders of other countries. First, as 2017 gets rolling, our next guest says the future is looking bright for five bands making music here in Wisconsin. Piet Levy joins us now to share their stories and sounds. He's a music writer at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Piet, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote a piece on five bands to keep an eye on and an ear on in 2017. Is there any kind of common denominator between the five groups you're looking at?
I've done this list for a few years now, every year. It's really looking at artists who they just have a certain type of style and sound that really kind of cuts through. I mean, there's just obviously so many artists out there, but they have a sound that's really distinct. And they also just have a business savvy, a certain drive, a certain ambition, and kind of the freedom and opportunity to kind of really try to take it far. So in previous years, bands that we featured have included like Fox before they got really big, and Volcano Choir with Justin Vernon, and Gold, which is doing quite well in Milwaukee and regionally. Acts like That Vinyl Theater, who signed a few by Ramen. So these are artists who are doing some really interesting things, have already kind of made some good groundwork with their careers, and will probably go further.
So these are talented bands with a lot of stick-to-itiveness and effort, which is kind of where I went wrong in my career on both of those scores, I think. Let's start with an artist named Sarah Voss. She's heading the band Dead Horses. Talk about her story and her sound a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Dead Horses is an Americana. At this point, it's a duo, but they work with traveling musicians, and they're based in Milwaukee, although Sarah herself is from Oshkosh. And Sarah really loved music as a child, and kind of strayed from that and was at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee to study education. And she had kind of like a late 20s crisis, existential crisis, where she just wasn't quite sure if this is really what she needed to do. And it really kind of unearthed a lot of things for her, where she basically left school and quit her job, moved back to Oshkosh, and just was lost. And she found her way again through music. She just happened to jam with some old friends, and the band was Dead Horses, this kind of, bluegrassy, it's kind of since emerged to be more kind of folky Americana act. And that was 2010 when she started jamming with them, and they just through constant touring, constant playing, constant, music, they keep growing and growing and growing. And Sarah is a really interesting songwriter and has a really beautiful voice. Her songs can be, really kind of heartbreaking and devastating and really inspiring almost in the same song. She has a really good way, a good way with the pen. And this band just kind of keeps growing. So they were signed last year to the same agent who oversees Trampled by Turtles, which is a bluegrass group from Minnesota that has done really well. At this point, they're headlining the Riverside Theater in Milwaukee, which is 2,500 seats. So they used to play tiny places. Now they're playing big theaters. And they worked with Ken Coomer, who was a founding member of Wilco, who produced their last album. And they sold out a couple shows in Milwaukee, and they're doing really well. They're on their longest tour ever right now. They're going to be out on the road through April and be gigging all year long. Definitely a band to watch. Really interesting. Doing some really good stuff.
Let's give a listen to Dead Horses. The song is Golden Sky.
Sometimes I wish I was a leaf. Sometimes I wish I was a tall tree. Sometimes I wish I was a deep sea swimmer. Sometimes I wish I was a rock. Sometimes I wish I was a tall cornstalk.
Oh, and I wish we could listen to a little more, but I want to get through some more artists, Piet. You also have a Madison artist on your list. I think you've told us about him in the past, Trappo, a rapper, when he's performing. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Trappo is Davon Prather, and he started rapping when he was in grade school. His uncle was an amateur rapper in Madison. He would sing and rap on his tracks, and in grade school he was like writing verses for himself, and then started really taking it seriously in high school. When he was 16, this is amazing. It's so naive, but so cool. He would start to record his songs, start to take it seriously. And he's just, he's just a kid, a 16-year-old kid in Madison. He didn't really know what to do. So he would follow artists that he liked and the blogs that covered the artists that he liked. and he would hit up like Twitter followers of those blogs and like literally basically spam lots of just random people with his music. And it kind of worked. It got him this word of mouth going. It kind of grew on SoundCloud. His SoundCloud streams kind of kept growing. He ended up finding his managers that way. They finally heard about him. And his managers secured some pretty good writes for him. Pitches and Planes is a kind of a trend-setting hip-hop site that did a premiere for him when he was just 17. And he's only 18 now. So Pitches and Planes has written about him. XFL Mag is another big site. You know, Complex has done stuff on him. And his main song, Chicago, has been streamed 800,000 times on Spotify. And again, he's just 18. Released a really ambitious full-length album last year, Shade Trees, which really kind of shows his versatility. And he's a really skilled rapper, but he's also a really good skilled singer. He's got this very soulful style to him. It's pretty cool.
And here is that song, Chicago, by Trappo.
Let me talk for a second. I done seen hella Latin broads in my direction. Valley girls with expensive cars in my profession. Lot of places to show you what I'm on. I better dress her. Right, she heard my songs before I came in. Tell your man to calm down. You know he snuck the dirt in. Right. I know you ain't from Chicago.
And, you know, very different music than Dead Horses, but I say one thing in common between the two. Very present voices. Very, you know, you really feel like they're there.
Yeah, absolutely. They really connect. I mean, yes. And for him to connect at the way he's connecting at 18 is really impressive. That's why he had to be on this list, because he's going far.
Talking to Piet Levy, music writer from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at some Wisconsin bands to watch out for this year in 2017. He writes this article each year looking for some big names. Let's give a listen to another one, Soul Low. The song is Tied in Knots. They are from Milwaukee. Here's a taste.
Don't get tied in knots, trying to be popular, because you're not. Looks so good online, but in life you're behind. Wait till you go away. Come Saturday night, you like to peel away.
So tell us some about Solo.
Well, Solo is a really interesting band in the sense that a couple of them knew each other since kindergarten. We were kind of jamming as kids. They were in kind of a, you know, bluesy, kind of jazzy band that would play like farmers markets in the Milwaukee area. Solo emerged in 2013, really kind of broke out then with this kind of playful style of kind of slacker pop. And they had an album in 2013, 2015, an EP that got some national, international attention. Even Spin magazine claimed them to be a band to watch. So what was interesting is they had this kind of sound, but for last year's album, Nosebleeds, they kind of blew it up. They, you know, it's still a solo album, but it's much more ambitious, much more expansive, much more sprawling. The music has good hooks, but it's also very complex and interesting. It's really good. It got a lot of attention regionally, and it's got attention kind of beyond. And they already have a follow-up basically ready to go. It's going to be coming out this spring. And one of the guys, the last guy that's in college, is graduating in May. So, you know, they've been touring pretty aggressively, but once he's out of college, they're going to really kind of take this full throttle.
And that's, I should say, two words, Solo. It sounds, you know, you say it out loud, it sounds like Solo. Yeah, talk about them as a live act a little bit.
They're just really fun. They've got this really great kind of charismatic style. The main singer, Jake Balestieri, he has this kind of sort of like whiny nasal that's probably a little bit reminiscent of Violent Femmes. Which can be a little bit polarizing, but I think their style is still so interesting and distinct. And again, this last album really showed that they're, you know, one of their catchier songs, earlier songs, was called OMG STD. They've really kind of evolved from that. You know, they still can be a little bit cheeky, a little bit playful, but they're good musicians, really good musicians doing really complicated, interesting things. And they're really jazzed about this next album. They think it's the best thing they've ever done, so I can't wait to hear it.
Let's move on to another one on your list. The artist Milo, he's appeared on our series Set List, our summer music series here on Central Time. Tell us a little bit about Milo.
Milo's a really interesting story, too. Roy Ferrer is his name, and he grew up, also his uncle was Nizam, who's kind of a battle rapper from Chicago, kind of emulated him a little bit, and started taking his music seriously, in high school and then in college. A close friend of his had died, and he created this album or this mixtape, I Wish My Brother Rob Was Here, which was basically a tribute to him, and it was a way for him to kind of process his grief. But, you know, it got some attention. It got some blog attention. And, he was still at St. Norbert studying philosophy, and yet he was going between studying philosophy and doing papers to, like, playing, you know, touring. He was at South by Southwest working on like college papers in between sets of South by Southwest in 2013. Got enough attention that he went to LA in 2014 and was on the label Hellfire Club, which used to be the home for Anderson .Paak, who's gotten a lot of attention. But he struggled out there. He was broke. He was starving. He wasn't getting the breaks that he really needed. He kind of came to Milwaukee, you know, to regroup and release this album, So the Flies Don't Come. Didn't have huge expectations for it because he's just kind of self-releasing it. He, you know, kind of essentially failed in L.A. But this album is so good. He's able to bring this kind of very, you know, philosophical perspective to it. He's, you know, inspired by, like, Heidegger and Henry Dumas. I mean, it's a really interesting album with a lot of literary references and a lot of philosophy in there, poetic verses in there. Very interesting stuff, and it got a lot of attention. Rolling Stone picked him as an artist to watch, and he won like a hip hop bracket on Mass Appeal, beating heavy hitters like Kendrick Lamar and Drake to be the best album in 2015. So, really interesting. No artists like him, not just in Wisconsin, but anywhere.
Let's definitely listen to a little bit of Milo.
My college specialized and wrote Zionism. There's scars that come with broken fire pistons, Renaissance dunce with a bus of blunders, tracing the fault line, trying to defend my distance. Big old painting of myself like I'm Lonnie Liston, the auto-tune pilot of modernity on autopilot, yearning for eternity.
A distinctive sound there. And Pete, I want to get to the another artist on your list, Shane Leonard from Eau Claire, of course, the big music scene there. And he's been with a couple prominent bands himself. Can you tell us about Shane Leonard?
Yeah, the main act he's probably best known for, associated with, is Field Report, which is a Milwaukee act that was also on a Bands to Watch list a couple years ago. And Shane, when he joined the group as a drummer and a multi-instrumentalist for the albums, he really kind of expanded the sound. It used to be a much more sparse album that really made the lyrics the center of attention. The lyrics still lead, but Shane, in part, helped to really expand it to be a much more cinematic sound to complement those lyrics and make those lyrics even richer.
Okay,
I
want to get a quick taste of the music here before we run out of time. Shane Leonard, sure. Parting Ground is the song.
Let's take the old road in the old growth and scratch our skin. Nobody's gonna be around, just you and me in this parting ground.
And a little bit briefly, he had a little bit of a jazzy sound there with that upright bass.
Yeah, definitely jazz influence. He learned Clawmaster banjo, Clawhammer banjo from Appalachian Masters. He's a great student of music, has really expanded Field Report, but does really interesting solo stuff. His last stage name was Kalispell. So you'll find Printer's Son was last album released under Kalispell, but he's going to go by his own name going forward.
We'll leave it there. Piet, thanks a lot for sharing this great Wisconsin music with us.
Thanks for having me, and go to jsonline.com/music. You can find a lot more on all these artists.
That's Piet Levy, music writer at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, sharing some artists to watch out for this year in Wisconsin. Coming up, we talk foreign policy and President Trump. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Tonight, Ken and his guests take stock of Donald Trump's first week as president and what we've learned so far. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network. First, British Prime Minister Theresa May is in the United States this week to talk to President Trump. Her visit makes her the first foreign leader to meet with President Trump since he took the oath of office last Friday. Trump is scheduled to have a phone conversation with Russian President Vladimir Putin tomorrow afternoon, I believe. And even though this is his first diplomatic visit that he's received, President Trump's first week in office has made waves in the diplomatic community. Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto canceled his scheduled trip to the U.S. after President Trump doubled down on his desire to build a wall between the two countries, and longtime top officials at the State Department resigned unexpectedly this week. Nehal Tusi joins us to talk about all this news. She's the foreign affairs reporter for Politico. Nehal, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. I am a foreign affairs reporter for Politico.
They have more than one. Good point.
On my own.
There's a lot of foreign affairs to cover. Fair enough. Well, let's start with some breaking news this afternoon. President Trump has been putting out a lot of memoranda and other things this week, presidential executive actions. This new one, he's calling on vetting measures to, quote, keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the U.S. Did he give any indication of who would be targeted by these measures and what they would be?
So at this moment, the White House has not yet released the final text of this order. So what we know is based on drafts that have been circulating over the past week, and it's entirely possible that what he signed today is substantially different than what's in the drafts. I want to be really clear about that. But what's in the drafts contains a number of things that are targeting mainly refugees, as well as people who want to visit the United States or immigrate to the United States from a handful of Muslim-majority countries. And basically, also, I should say, Donald Trump wants to ban Syrian refugees indefinitely until he is satisfied that the program is strong enough that they can be allowed back in, and there's no time frame on that. He wants to halt all refugee admissions for at least 120 days while the program is reviewed. He wants to cut the number of refugees that the U.S. accepts this year down to 50,000 from 110,000. And he wants to basically halt or suspend the visas issuance to people in a handful of countries, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Sudan for sure, possibly Libya, Yemen, and Somalia as well. And also the drafts have indicated that he wants to, he's asking his officials to come up with a plan to establish safe zones inside Syria. But the drafts have been very vague about that. So if the final order is the same as the draft, it's just full of a lot of very, very complicated orders that, frankly, are going to be difficult to implement and, in some cases, legally very challenging.
Some people have been pointing out that the drafts, again, assuming that the final order matches the drafts, the countries singled out for special attention don't include countries that were the source of the, for example, the 9/11 attackers, places like Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Is that right?
That's correct. That's one of the strange things. I mean, I honestly don't know of a situation where a Sudanese person has attacked the United States in a terrorist attack. I'm not saying it hasn't happened, but yeah, you have countries like Sudan and Iraq also, which is technically an ally of the United States, and Iran, of course, which is not. But you don't have countries like Saudi Arabia, which had 15 of the 19 hijackers on September 11th were Saudis, Egypt, where there is Islamist activity and included at least one of the hijackers. And places like Pakistan and Afghanistan, Pakistan in particular, has been a huge source of terrorist recruits. So the choices are really odd, and possibly it could speak to the fact that the Trump administration values its alliance with Egypt's leader right now. The Saudis may simply be too powerful to anger in this particular way. But I will add this one thing. Generally speaking, overall, Trump wants, according to the drafts, much stricter vetting across the board. He has said he doesn't want people coming to this country who, you know, he believes oppress gay people, for example. So it's possible that our consular officials who are dealing with people, say, from Saudi Arabia who want a visa, may start asking questions like, what is your stance on homosexuality? And if someone says, I oppose it, then they might not give them the visa. So it could impact those countries, but not quite as directly as the other ones that are mentioned.
A lot of maybes still, it sounds like, on this. Want to move on to some of the other diplomatic news. We have Theresa May coming from Britain. The British Prime Minister now met with President Trump, a news conference together today. What were some of the big stories that came out of that?
Well, it sounds as if Theresa May and Trump, you know, they sounded like they had a decent conversation, but I'm not sure that she walked away with all the promises that she wanted. She said that she impressed upon him that he should keep sanctions on Russia, for instance, and that he told her that he supports NATO 100%. At the same time, Theresa May is really hopeful of getting a bilateral trade deal with the U.S. And the thing is, you know, promises on that front are, they're all fine right now, but they depend on so many things, such as when the United Kingdom actually leaves the European Union. There's all sorts of rules, and it's not really clear, frankly, that Trump has thought all of this out just yet.
Talking to Nihal Tusi from Politico, looking at foreign affairs, foreign relations under the new administration of President Donald Trump. Staying with that British state visit here, there's kind of some tension there. Prime Minister May talked about, yeah, we agree with President Trump. We don't want to get entangled in long, complicated foreign wars, referring, I assume, to Iraq there. But she's hoping for a commitment for U.S. backing of NATO, sticking to NATO to prevent further expansion from Russia.
That's right. It's, you know, she wants a combination of things. And it's going to be hard to say how it will all end up working out. Because, for instance, you know, she says that it's not a good idea to do these long, drawn-out wars. At the same time, Trump today, according to the draft, I should say, wants his team to come up with an idea for a safe zone inside Syria. And that could, in the long run, lead to U.S. troops having to get involved in another Middle Eastern war. And so on that front, the U.S. often turns to its allies, such as the U.K., for assistance and to NATO for assistance. And will Britain back the U.S. then? Theresa May made it sound like, you know, she doesn't want any part of that. So these things are it's just all going to depend on a host of different factors, many of them that are interlinked on a number of levels that I'm not sure that the new administration entirely appreciates just yet.
Well, linked to both Great Britain and Syria is the issue of relations with Russia. President Trump, again, scheduled to talk to Vladimir Putin tomorrow. A big question mark there through the campaign. Senator John McCain has said he wants to start looking at congressional action to maintain sanctions on Russia, even if Donald Trump tries to abandon those sanctions. What are you watching for in this conversation tomorrow and moving forward?
This is really going to be extraordinary. Donald Trump said today that, you know, he doesn't know the gentleman. He referred to Mr. Putin. And it's just going to be fascinating to see how their conversation goes and if they decide to meet in person as well. That being said, there has been some consideration, according to Trump's team, of possibly just unilaterally, that's a tough word today for me, trying to lift the sanctions on Russia that are related to Ukraine. But that, of course, is going to upset a lot of people in Europe. And that's another factor that the Trump team has to consider. And whether that's ultimately going to work out could all depend also on Congress, because, I mean, not even counting the Democrats, who obviously are up in arms over the idea of lifting sanctions, many, many leading Republicans, including John McCain and Lindsey Graham, are adamantly opposed to the idea of lifting sanctions on Russia. They're very hawkish on Russia. And McCain and Graham have even said that if Trump tries to lift unilaterally a lot of these sanctions, Congress will come back and impose legislation or push through legislation to puts the sanctions back in. And so that's going to end up being a fight within the Republican Party. And it's just, it's extraordinary. It's amazing. He's been on the job 1 week, and so much has already happened.
Well, here's a twist I hadn't considered. You wrote about it. Right now, the U.S. shares intelligence data, the intelligence community does, with intelligence agencies of our allies. You write that American spies, people in the intelligence trade, are worried that cooperation could come to an end if the United States is too close to Russia, who a lot of these European agencies are worried about, and worried about, hey, is our information going to go via the U.S. administration to Russia?
That's entirely right. I mean, some of the folks feel very worried about that. And it's not just Russia. Israel, for instance, is worried that if the Trump team shares information with Russia, that the Russians will share that information with the Iranians who are working with the Russians in Syria. That's how complicated all this is. But I should add one other thing. Another concern of a lot of the U.S. spies and their allies overseas is just that Trump is himself so off the cuff in his remarks. He is a bit erratic or kind of unpredictable in what he does say, when he does say it, where he does say it. So there's just some concern that if they share information and it reaches the president's ears, he might, you know, perhaps inadvertently just share it or spill it out in a way that actually hurts those countries' very hard-fought methods and sources.
Nihal Tusi is with us now to talk about foreign policy news in the new presidential administration. We still haven't gotten to Mexico yet. That's coming up. Nihal's a foreign affairs reporter at Politico. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of what we've been hearing from President Trump and his administration on foreign policy 1 week in? What role should the U.S. play in the world? And what are you looking for when it comes to Russia, to NATO, to Mexico? Call 800-642-1234, or Syria for that matter. 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. More coming up. Maybe we'll hear from you on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about U.S. foreign policy over the last week under the new administration. Nihal Tusi is with us, foreign affairs reporter at Politico, looking at a lot of news since last Friday's inauguration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with some of the policy platforms of building a wall, changing refugee policy in the United States that President Trump has advocated for? What about those question marks? Should we make a strong, continue a strong commitment to NATO? Should we continue to have sanctions on Russia over annexation of Ukrainian territory? What do you want our relationship with Mexico to look like? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on our Central Time Facebook page. Nihal, all this has been going on. We haven't talked about Mexico yet. A meeting scheduled, then canceled, with the Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto. Tell us the story there.
Well, this is really, to me, the most remarkable story of this week. Mexico is America's third largest trading partner. It is America's neighbor. 6 million U.S. jobs, at least 6 million, depend on that relationship. And yet, within a week, it's come under extraordinary strain. Actually, I guess longer than a week, considering how President Trump acted during a campaign toward Mexico. But this is, the stakes are really, really high. And what basically ended up happening was that traditionally, the Mexican president comes to visit the United States soon after a new president takes office. And President Peña Nieto was going to be here on January 31st. He sent some people ahead of time to prepare for the meeting. Some of his top officials came. And the day that they were supposed to meet with White House officials, it was announced that Donald Trump was going to be issuing executive orders on immigration and border enforcement. Orders that in many ways are very offensive to Mexicans. And then the next morning, on the second day of those meetings, Trump tweeted out something that basically suggested that if Enrique Peña Nieto did not care for what he was doing, that he should just cancel the meeting. And so that is what Enrique Peña Nieto did. And the Mexican president, you have to understand, is facing a lot of domestic pressure. He is considered weak because he hasn't stood up enough to Trump. And he has, like, a very, very low popularity. So he has to kind of do this to safeguard what little political base he has left. That being said, you know, things went very sour very quickly, but today Trump and Peña Nieto held a phone call. We were told it was about an hour long, that it went well. We don't know really ultimately what the results of it will be, but I think both sides are starting to understand. Certainly, you know, the Mexicans understand it. It seems like the Trump team perhaps is understanding that, you know, doing a trade war with Mexico is going to have a lot of repercussions on a lot of people. And a lot of people among the people who are unhappy about this are Republican lawmakers, including from places like Arizona and Texas, border states that have strong ties to Mexico.
Right. People are pointing toward this being a little more complicated. Some factory jobs have moved from the United States to Mexico, but some people are pointing to companies that have a supply chain that involves exporting stuff into Mexico, importing stuff back in the United States. It's a complicated picture. Slapping up a wall and maybe tariffs, though that it's not clear what was going on with talk of tariffs, could really complicate things, couldn't it?
Exactly. It could just put in a lot of structural barriers, physically and, like, you know, not physically, that could really undermine the relationship on a lot of levels. And the other thing to actually point out is there are actually a number of top Mexican companies that own American companies. And that's another relationship that could affect get affected in a negative way. So it's extremely complicated. And at the same time, you know, the relationship with Mexico is not just about trade and immigration. It's also about counterterrorism. It's also about tourism. It's also about counter-narcotics. That's a big one. And over the last 20 years, Mexico really has gotten a lot closer to the United States in its outlook and in its cooperation. And it seems like a lot of that is now at stake.
We just have another minute left, Nihal. I wanted to ask you about this news from the State Department. A lot of top officials leaving there. Rex Tillerson and hasn't been confirmed yet. People saying from the Trump administration, oh, this is normal, cleaning house, out with the old, in with the new. Some people saying, yeah, but these positions usually stick around for a while, at least to the transition. What do you make of what we're seeing there?
I definitely think it's the Trump team cleaning house of a lot of people that they consider too tarred because of their association with the Obama administration. And you're right, some of these folks, they handle very complicated, often technical things like managing diplomatic security, that sort of thing. But traditionally, when a new administration comes in, these people are required to submit their resignations, and then it's up to the new administration to accept those resignations or not. Normally, they have them stay on for a while just because it helps with the continuity. But in this particular case, a whole host of them have been told that their resignations have been accepted. That has left some people at the State Department really worried that you're going to see even more people leave. But also just, you know, it's also talent loss and also loss of managerial skills and knowledge at a time when there really haven't been any replacements announced. And that's the thing. So you could have like a largely leaderless organization kind of trying to figure out what it's supposed to do at what could be a very critical time.
Nahal, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
That's Nahal Tusi, foreign affairs reporter for Politico, looking at foreign affairs and the Trump administration. Federal agents with the Drug Enforcement Administration raided a small clinic in Chippewa County last week that specialized in treating chronic pain and addiction. Some in the community have applauded the DEA for shutting down a suspected narcotics pill mill. Others say the raid has cut off a life-saving source of medicine, keeping patients from using illegal drugs. As Rich Kramer reports, it's the latest chapter in the long and complicated history of opioid medications and addiction here in Wisconsin.
I'm just trying to get help.
Fritz Cromwell of Blair is afraid of what comes next. If he can't get a doctor to refill his twice-daily 10-milligram methadone prescription, he'll break out in sweats, severe nausea, and diarrhea.
It's like a double-barrel shotgun. The sickness is going to kick in, and the pain is going to kick in. And if you ever seen the inside of my body, you would think the Lusitania has nothing on me.
Cromwell is talking about the steel rods up his back and neck. After breaking his spine, numerous surgeries have left 4-inch scars where vertebrae were rebuilt. He says he lived with chronic pain and was addicted to drugs like heroin and crack. But 16 years ago, he got clean with the help of Dr. Clifford Bovey.
I guess I gave my life to Dr. Bovey and God, more or less. And he was like a father to me.
That came to an end when federal agents raided Dr. Bovey's Cadott Medical Center last week.
Gals from the DEA dropped in and want to review all my charts.
Dr. Bovey says agents found banned medications and blank prescriptions he'd already signed, a time saver that's also illegal. Bovey says he agreed to stop prescribing narcotic painkillers indefinitely. A pharmacist next door said his records were confiscated as well. The DEA and U.S. Attorney's Office wouldn't confirm the doctor's statements because of an ongoing investigation. Staff at the Cadott Medical Center estimate Dr. Bovey treated around 200 patients for chronic pain and addiction. Some drove 100 miles each way to get high doses. Dr. Bovey says other doctors wouldn't prescribe.
That's how I got this kind of high-risk population, that when somebody looks at it, it looks like I'm overprescribing. But I try to have my prescriptions well thought out. I know what the endpoints of toxicity are, and I monitor them closely, give them Narcan for injection if they get too much.
Dr. Bovey says his prescriptions kept patients off street drugs, but also made him a target. In 2012, he was reprimanded and fined by the Wisconsin Medical Examining Board for failing to properly diagnose chronic pain and prescribing narcotics without proper justification. The state currently has 3 open investigations against him.
For the addict community, he was a huge source.
That's a woman we'll call S, who declined to use her real name. She says a close relative began seeing the doctor for pain in 2008. Soon after, she says she started seeing signs of opiate addiction. The relative withdrew and eventually left the state and 2 children behind. That was after S proved to Dr. Bovey the relative was doctor shopping.
I think he trusted people too much, and the community could not believe that he could do that to people.
Federal guidelines released last year encourage doctors to avoid prescribing opioids and to use lower doses in special cases. Dr. Alaa Abdel Saeed of the UW Hospital Pain Clinic says even with the best intentions, doctors relying on narcotic painkillers aren't doing patients any favors.
We have to know that prescribing opioids will harm them down the road. So based on our sympathy, we should actually be very careful about prescribing opioids.
At the shuttered Kadat Medical Center, the phone has been ringing off the hook as panicking patients call for answers. Staff have been working to transfer records to other doctors in hopes they can treat those patients facing chronic pain and the sickness of opiate withdrawal. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.